performing ministry responsibilities with confidence. Number 6, there are really only 3 types of church government systems the majority of us will run into in America: the Episcopalian system, the Presbyterian system, and the Congregational system. The church with which you are involved in probably falls in one of these 3 categories. An examination of each of these systems will prove beneficial to our study. In the Episcopal system, or the hierarchical system, as some refer to it, the ruling body of clergy is organized into orders or ranks, each of which is subordinate to the one above it. Authority resides in the bishops. The number of varying levels of bishops vary from denomination to denomination. The hierarchy in the Methodist system of authority is probably the least absolute, with only 1 level of bishops. The hierarchy of authority is even more pronounced in the Episcopal Church. The Roman Catholic Church has the most complete system of hierarchy. The logical end of the structure leads to the Supreme Pontiff, the Bishop of Rome, otherwise known as the Pope. The Anglican Church of England combines both the episcopal and national forms of government. And there is no question as to where the authority lies in the episcopal system, for it resides in a fixed office, resides in the bishop. There are different levels of ministry or degrees of ordination within the episcopal system. The ordinary minister or priest consists of the first level. This is broken down into steps or levels within some denominations, such as elder and deacon. At this level, the clergy are authorized to perform all of the basic duties associated with the ministry, such as preaching and administering the sacraments. Additionally, there is also a second level of ordination, which lifts one to be a bishop invested with special powers that are not granted at the first level. In the hierarchical system, the bishop is central to the functioning of church government. Some high church Anglicans and the Roman Catholics might suggest that the episcopal form of government is necessary to the very being of the church, while low church Anglicans may see the system of bishops as but one of a number of forms of church government with scriptural merit. Although they would not view episcopacy as necessary for the very being of the church, I think they would agree that it is, in their opinion, the best system for doing the work of the kingdom, and thus perhaps necessary for the well-being of the church. Other churches retain the office of bishop, but with considerably lessened powers. Over the years, for instance, in the Methodist Church, the power granted to bishops has varied. The duty of the bishop is to exercise the power of God which has been vested in him. As God's representatives and as pastors, they govern and care for a group of churches rather than caring for merely one local congregation. Bishops have the power to ordain ministers or priests. By laying hands upon a candidate for ordination, the bishop endows in the candidate the powers which belong to the ministry. Second, bishops also have the power of pastoral placement. Although the bishop has absolute power to place a minister in a particular location, in practice, however, in recent years, the episcopacy has leaned toward greater democratization. The bishop usually consults the local congregation regarding their wishes and sometimes even allows them a significant role in the matter. This is found much more so in the Methodist Church than in the Catholic Church. Third, a bishop has the responsibility of preserving and maintaining the true faith and proper order and discipline within a specific geographical area. Past history reveals that bishops have exercised wide influence and responsibilities. By laying on of hands in the ceremony of ordination, the authority of the apostles has been transmitted down through history to the bishops of today. Known as the theory of apostolic succession, modern bishops have the authority of the apostles, authority which the apostles had received from Jesus Christ himself. Bishops are not chosen from below or from the congregation, per se. Rather, they are chosen from above by an archbishop or other bishops. In the Roman Catholic Church, the supreme bishop came to be referred to as the Pope, the father of the entire church. And he governs through archbishops who oversee large geographical areas. And beneath them are the bishops to whom priests are responsible. Up until Vatican Council I, 1869 and 1870, the Pope was viewed as having supreme authority, but only when he acted in conjunction with the other bishops. At Vatican I, however, it was decided that the Pope had supreme and unlimited authority in his own right as it related to matters of faith and practice when he spoke ex cathedra or in his official capacity. Now, when he spoke ex cathedra, he is infallible. The character of his authority was never defined because immediately after the decision was made, the Franco-Prussian War broke out and the council had to adjourn before it determined just what infallibility meant. Vatican II, in a sense, attempted to complete the unfinished business of Vatican I. There is a difference of opinion as to when the Pope is speaking ex cathedra, because he just doesn't, you know, preface his decrees with, "Now I am speaking ex cathedra." He just doesn't do that. So determining when he is speaking ex cathedra and has been debated, and there's difference of opinion on that particular issue. The popes have been very cautious about identifying their decrees as ex cathedra because once made, the ruling can never be reversed or altered. So if you're going to say something ex cathedra, you better be careful what you say and how you say it, because it's not going to be reversed or altered. In actuality, the Pope exercises his authority through the bishops. They have received their powers from him. He is the top authority, so the authority begins at the top with him and it flows downward. The only check upon his powers is the fact that he does not appoint his successor. The new Pope is elected by the College of Cardinals. However, the Pope appoints the cardinals, and the new Pope is selected from their number. So, in a sense, the Pope does have an influence, to a certain degree, in who his successor might be. There are several arguments brought forth to support this type of governance system. Since Christ is the principal founder of the Church, he provided it with an authoritative governing structure. Immediately after stating that all authority in heaven and on earth is his in Matthew 28:18, he sent forth the 11 apostles in that authority, verses 19 and 20, and Acts chapter 1, verse 8. It should be noted that the apostles are the only officers we know of whom Jesus appointed. The apostles did begin to delegate their authorities to others, such as Timothy and Titus. We see that. The apostles also appointed elders or rulers in local churches. And as Paul and Barnabas traveled through Galatia, encouraging and strengthening the churches they had begun, Acts 14:23 says, "And when they had appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed." even in cases where it is unclear that the apostles did the choosing, it was they who did the ordaining. The church in Jerusalem chose 7 men to assist in the work of ministry. Acts 6:6 says, "And these they brought before the apostles, and after praying, they laid their hands on them." A second argument in support of this view is the authoritative position held by James within the church. His authority was similar to that later held by bishops. So, in essence, James's position is a precedent for the episcopal system. Third, historically, the direct line of succession from the apostles to today's bishops supports the episcopal system. It is believed that through the ordination process, the authority of the apostles has been passed down through history to the bishops of modern day. Fourth, it is argued that the organization of the church subsequent to New Testament days supports this system. In the time of Ignatius, the threefold ministry of bishop, priest, and deacon was clearly in existence in Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. By the end of the 2nd century, it is attested for Gaul and Africa by the writings of Irenaeus and Tertullian. If Presbyterian or Congregationalism was the divinely appointed pattern of government, then why wasn't there a violent uprising with the implementation of episcopacy? There are also various arguments against the episcopal form of church government. One argument believes that the system is far too formalized, that it tends to place more emphasis upon the office instead of the person who holds the office. In the New Testament, authority was given only to those who were spiritually qualified and of sound doctrine. What a person believes and how that person behaves is far more important than any position that might be held. The latter should be determined by the former, and not the former by the latter. Furthermore, many take exception to the theory of apostolic succession. Although various individuals are reported to have laid their hands on others, there is no explicit evidence of anyone conveying the power to ordain. There is no biblical description of any very highly developed and organized government, nor is there any command to perpetuate a particular form of government. In addition, there is little evidence or no evidence to support a difference in authority between elders and bishops. Bishops and elders are usually considered to be referring to the same office. The transference of power from the apostles to the bishops is never discussed or regulated in the New Testament. The Didache, a church manual at the end of the first century, instructed each congregation to choose its own bishops and deacons, 15 verse 1. And this is totally contrary to the concept of apostolic succession. Finally, this form of government gives insufficient attention to Christ's direct exercise of lordship over the church. For instance, he installed Paul without any intermediary. There was no other apostle involved in that instance. Paul himself makes this very point as he justifies his apostleship in Galatians chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. If Paul received his office directly from God, isn't it possible that others might receive an office in a similar manner directly from God? In this case, apostolic authority does not seem to rest upon previous apostolic authority. Well, this is the Episcopalian or hierarchical system of government. I have listed both the support for and the arguments against this type of government structure for you. Well, next, let's consider the Presbyterian form of church government, or as some have called it, the federal government system. No pun intended with the federal government in Washington, D.C. In this form of government, importance is placed upon the office as well, but there is less emphasis upon the individual office and office holder, and more emphasis upon a series of representative bodies which exercise authority. In this system, individual members give some of their powers to leaders. And in cases where there is a denominational structure, it also means that individual churches give up aspects of autonomy to a higher organizational structure. The Presbyterian and Reform groups are structured along this line. Also forming to this structure are a number of independent Bible churches. Their federalism is limited to the local church because, by virtue of being independent, they do not have a denominational organizational structure that has power over individual churches. So Presbyterian-type denominations involve presbyteries, synods, and general assemblies, whereas Presbyterian-type local churches without a denominational structure do not. The key officer in the Presbyterian form of government is the elder, a position with allusions back to the Jewish synagogue. In Old Testament times, there were elders who governed or ruled in leadership capacities. The New Testament also speaks of elders. In Acts chapter 11, verse 30, reveals for us the presence of elders in the Jerusalem church. When fellow believers in Antioch provided relief to the church in Jerusalem, they sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. Paul and Barnabas appointed elders in churches, as seen in Acts 14:23. In Acts 20, verse 17, we find Paul calling the elder of Ephesus to Miletus so he could address them. There is also mention of elders in the pastoral epistles. Some who support the Presbyterian form of government maintain that the terms elder and bishop are synonymous, thus the term episkopos, or bishop, in passages like 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 2, and Titus chapter 1, verse 7, are to be understood as referring to elders. It should be pointed out that the term elder, presbyteros, usually occurs in the plural form, which suggests that the authority of the elders is as a collective group instead of with an individual elder. Exhortations like the ones found in Hebrews 13:17 and 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 12 through 13, seem to indicate that there was a group of presbyters that was in charge of local church affairs. In New Testament days, people chose elders to rule the church based on who they judged to be qualified for the position. In Acts chapter 1, verses 23 through 26, it was the whole congregation who put forth Matthias and Barsabbas as candidates to replace Judas among the apostles, with the final choice being made by the casting of lots. In their prayer, they asked God to reveal His choice from the two they had selected. In a similar situation in Acts 6, the entire body of believers at Jerusalem picked the seven men full of the Spirit and wisdom to assist the apostles. Although the synagogue had elders, this New Testament practice of selection by the congregation was quite different. In the synagogue, elder selection was basically based on seniority. When choosing elders to rule the church, the congregation seemed cognizant of the fact that God had given them the authority to select leaders, but they also wanted to confirm it with the Lord. They used their authority to select leaders, but are very mindful that God was the ultimate one who chose them. Paul urges the elders of Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, verse 28. Be on guard for yourselves and for all the flock, among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. In the Greek, overseers translates the word episkopoi, which means bishops. In other words, God the Holy Spirit chose you to be leaders. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 28, we read, and God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues. It is assumed that the office of bishop or elder is implied in this list of God's choosing. Matthew 16:19, John 20:22-23, and Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 12 are other passages that seem to indicate that God chooses the officers of the church.